Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Well, welcome again to Circles of Change. It's always a pleasure to call across the continent, indeed, to speak with Dr. Moshe Milevsky from York University in Toronto. Good morning, sir. How are you today?
Very well. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Let me give you a brief introduction. Moshe Milevsky, he's a tenured professor in the Department of Finance and a member of the Graduate Faculty of Mathematics at York University in Toronto, Canada. He has graduate degrees in finance and mathematics and is a fellow and director of the Field Institute for Research in Mathematical Studies. Moshe has written 9 books, published over 60 peer-reviewed studies, over 200 magazine articles, including a feature story in the Wall Street Journal, and also a monthly column in Research Magazine, all on the topic of financial planning. He's delivered over 1,000 seminars, keynote presentations, and training sessions to audiences all over the world, and his popular writing indeed earned him 2 National Canadian Magazine Awards, and in 2009 he was given a Lifetime Achievement Award from the U.S.-based Retirement Income Industry Association, even though he's in his early 40s. So if we've ever wondered the point of all that high school mathematics that we've taken, Moshe's answer is so that you can figure out how to retire while you still have enough money to enjoy it. Well, again, congratulations on all those accolades, and glad you're with us today.
Thank you.
Well, the book we're going to talk about, in fact, is Moshe's latest of his 9. It's called The 7 Most Important Equations for Your Retirement. And so everyone, lest our listeners say, oh, wait a minute, Zara's going to go off in the quant world here, I want you to understand this is going to be a story and a journey about history and the people that made it happen. My question to you, Moshe, what prompted you to go in this direction, since your work otherwise is kind of bridging, you know, the analytical side to us practitioners, the history lesson?
Well, you know, for most of the time that I've been researching and doing writing in this area, I have been focused exclusively on the quant side, working out calculations, building spreadsheets, crunching the numbers. And, you know, at some point, about a year, year and a half ago, as I was doing a little bit of work in that field, I kind of stumbled on an equation that I was using that just struck me how important it was and how central it was. And I asked myself at the time, gee, I wonder who invented this.
Right,
you know,
right.
I use it on an almost daily basis. I teach it to my graduate students and undergraduate students. And I kind of, in a moment there, asked myself, gee, I wonder where this came from. And that kind of led me on a journey of trying to figure out the first mathematician or economist or actuary that had ever sat down and wrote these equations down. And that kind of got me into the history. And, you know, before I knew it, I was going back 800 years and learning about people that lived in the middle, you know, 1800s, 1700s, all the way back to Fibonacci, who lived 800 years ago.
And so what was that first equation that piqued your interest or kind of tripped you along this path?
Well, the first equation that got me on all of this was an equation about retirement spending. You know, it's a very big debate that people have, especially as they get into retirement. It's tough for youngsters to get a feel for that, but one of the most terrifying decisions that people face financially is how much they can afford to pull out from their nest egg.
You bet.
They're not earning a salary anymore. They're not earning a wage. They've got to turn on the tap. Mm-hmm. Instead of adding money to the bathtub, they've got to start pulling money out. They've been adding money for 20 or 30 years, and suddenly they have to pull some money out, and it's really scary. How much should you pull out? If you pull out too much, that's great. You get to enjoy all that money, but the money may run out. And if you pull out too little, A, you may not be able to live on that. Second of all, you end up leaving a lot more, and you could have spent more. So that whole question of how much can I spend comes down to an equation that balances out these risks. And the first person that actually wrote down a description of that equation was an economist that lived about 100 years ago, and his name was Irving Fisher, an American economist. He taught at Yale, a very, very well-known businessman as well. He was a consultant to presidents back in 1910, 1920. Fascinating fellow by the name of Irving Fisher, and he kind of put down what I consider to be one of the 7 most important equations for retirement. And, you know, that led me to another and yet another, and before I knew it, I had 7 of them.
And the fact that that you stopped at 7, or was it you felt you kept converging back to these 7 being the core?
Well, you know, I'll be the first to admit it gets a little bit subjective. And after I've published this book, it's been about a month and a half now, I've gotten emails and phone calls and, you know, people that have walked into my office at the university and have said, well, you know what, that fifth equation, you know, we probably could have done without. Could have been 6. And, you know, then I have people coming and saying, you know, there should have been an 8th. You should have had another one. But my point was really to get a debate going about there are very important calculations that we use consciously or subconsciously. Who gave us these equations? And that's really what this book is about. So I joke at the end of the book that maybe in the second edition, if there is a second edition, I'll change the title to The 9 Most Important if 2 more come along.
That's right. In fact, your closing chapter, you call it Controversies, Omissions, and Concluding Thoughts. So I think you're setting us up for the sequel already.
Yeah, in fact, and I'm glad to say I really predicted that one because I knew I was going to get people saying, hey, how come my equation isn't
exactly
there?
You know? Yeah, or that was my great-great-grandfather. Or, you know, that's the one that always tripped me up in business school when we did the calculations.
Sure, where is that one? So, you know, whether it's 7 or 8, but I felt that these were 7 really important ones, and they were self-contained and certainly separate. And to me, it was important not just the number 7 or the equations, but the fellow, the individual behind it, the fascinating story of the people that came up with these ideas and how they came up with these ideas and their personal life and defending their ideas over time. So that's really what this was about. It's really a biography.
And, you know, what I would venture to say, at least based on the introduction that I gave of you, was this book thus a challenge for you to write because it wasn't in the quant side? Or is there always this storyteller historian in you that's been wanting to bust loose for quite some time?
You know what? I enjoyed writing this book, I must say, and hopefully my other editors aren't listening here, more than I enjoyed writing the other 8 or 9 books that I've put together. But at the same time, when I sent this to the publisher, one of the first replies I got was, are you sure you can pull this off? Right? I'd sent a proposal, and I said, I want to write a biography of 7 fascinating people. And they said, well, that's not what you usually do. You're usually solving equations and writing down calculations. And I said, I really want to give this a try. And it was a little bit different for me, and I really enjoyed it, and I can see myself moving further in that kind of historical direction. It was very interesting reading about these people, and how do you distill someone like Edmund Halley, the famous astronomer, the Comet Halley that's named after him, how do you distill this person's life into a chapter and their influence that they've had on the retirement planning field? But it definitely was different from the other things that I've been doing.
So I've got to believe that, was there, though, any voice in your own head that says you got to be kidding, or, gee, Moshe, why don't you do this one under a pseudonym? In a different brand just to be safe?
It was tough. I went through many more drafts of things, and certainly my editor and you know, the folks that edit this at the publisher probably went through a lot more back and forth than the usual. And the initial manuscript had many more calculations and equations, and, you know, the editor felt, well, you know, if this is a biography, people don't want to see equations. They want to see stories. So it did take a little bit of back and forth, but I grew from the experience, and I really enjoyed it. And I could see myself doing more of this type of historical analysis going forward.
So we're coming up, of course, we're in the middle of summer. You're going to be this fall indicating to your students what books to read on the book list, and I'm sure some of your other 9 books get included. Are you going to throw this one on top so your students get a perspective of what or more you're about?
Well, I always feel guilty adding more things for students to read. They're overwhelmed as it is, but I'll certainly put it as a suggested reading. I'm not sure I'll require it quite yet.
So the book's been out a month and a half, and as you said, you've had people coming into your office and some emails and the like. What's been the response, or have you had any yet, from the financial planning market that otherwise reveres your books as Bibles to help them guide their clients, and now here we have a historical piece. Have you heard from anyone in that sector?
Well, you know, for the most part, the responses have been very positive. I think that people have become a little bit satiated. They've kind of had enough of these usual calculations, and how much money do you need in retirement, and what's the right stock mix, and what's the best mutual fund, and people like to hear something different. So giving it a historical perspective, for the most part, it's been positive. Now, granted, the title can be a bit intimidating, 7
equations,
retirement. You know, that's not something that that's going to sell as popular as other titles that don't mention equations in it. But, you know, overall, when people actually pick it up and thumb through it and they realize, oh, yeah, that, you know, the equations are just artwork. This is really a story about seven people and the work that they've done. And you kind of pick up the retirement planning along the way. You know, one of the equations I talk about is longevity. How long will people be spending in retirement? What are the odds that you'll make it to 90 or 95 or 100? Who makes it to 100? And what are the odds of people getting to those ages? And the first mathematician that worked on that problem formally was Benjamin Gompertz, a British actuary, lived about 200 years ago. Fascinating figure. Couldn't go to university. He wasn't allowed in because he was Jewish and there was a quota. You couldn't get into university. So he taught himself mathematics. He moved his way up the stratosphere, and at some point he was the chairman of the Royal Society, which is unheard of for someone that never went to university. I mean, he's a fascinating figure. I think more people should know about him, and that's really what this book is about.
Well, I think the other thing the book's about is that to think that how many modern contemporary decisions are based on formulas that were developed at a totally different time. I mean, generations back, where in some regard people say, well, all the rules have changed in financial planning. Well, yes and no, right? Because what you're saying is still the guiding lights are the guiding lights.
Yeah, they really have been. One of the things I joke about is that if Leonardo Fibonacci, one of the seven people that I profile, were alive today, he was an Italian mathematician, lived in the year 1300, he literally could have a conversation about retirement planning today and understand the issues that we're struggling with low interest rates and volatile stock markets and uncertain health care costs. He wrote about these issues. He used a different language. You talked about it in a different context, but we could have an intelligent conversation with someone about this who lived 800 years ago. He'd know what we're going through. So this idea that we're in unprecedented, unchartered new territory, some of it is really very old.
Mm-hmm. Well, granted, the investment instruments might be different or the markets in which they play in, but, you know, to your point, these seven individuals created that irrespective of context, in other words, which is highly unusual when you look back at history.
It is, in fact, you know, when you think of someone like Leonardo Fibonacci, he lived in Italy in the year 1300. He lived in an era where every city in Italy had its own currency and its own interest rate, which is a very complex environment. You'd go, you know, a couple of hundred miles to the north and you'd have a new city and you'd have to exchange currencies there and you'd get a different interest rate. And there were merchants doing commercial transactions. It was almost the center of the business world. How do you do these transactions with different interest rates and different currencies? It was a complex environment. And that's the world in which he lived. It's not surprising that he was an expert and he became a specialist in this. And in fact, when we talk about the euro and one currency for the entire Europe, we may go back to a period like what it was in Fibonacci's era, where every city has its own interest rate at this rate. And it's just interesting to see the past come back, and the struggles that they've had are very relevant for today.
Indeed. Chapter 5 is how much in risky stocks versus safe cash, and that you do such a fine job with Paul Samuelson, who passed away in 2009. I had the pleasure of being a student of his when I was at Stanford University. Yep. So to strike into a chapter, say, I know him, and then it kind of brings home the power of the kind of people that all of us on different occasions have a chance to meet. So my question would be, did you ever have a chance to meet Dr. Samuelson at any point in time?
I did, but I'm envious of you that he was actually, you were a student of his.
Yep.
I only had a chance to meet him once at a conference in passing. I had a minor correspondence with him about 15 years before he passed away while I was a graduate student, but he was certainly the only one of the seven that I've actually managed to meet because of the fact that he had just passed away a couple of years ago, and he was just an intellectual powerhouse in terms of his impact on economics and the profession, and the textbook that he wrote that is still used
everywhere.
Today. I believe it's in the 20th edition.
You bet.
So, yes, he was quite an instrumental figure in modern economics.
Well, and in fact, if you ever went to the Academy of Management, he was one of those that you felt it was almost as if you were following Paul McCartney from the Beatles. He was like an academic rock star. You couldn't get close to him, and the most humble person. My question would be, so he's sitting up in heaven looking down and reading your book, or he was on your shoulder as you wrote about him. What do you think his reaction is about your book right now?
Well, I hope that I gave it a balanced treatment, and I kind of gave the essence of what he was trying to say. Of course, his main comment or his main criticism of financial planning was that there was too much emphasis on time to retirement as opposed to stability of your job. You know, right now, one of the big issues people struggle with is how much of their money should be in the stock stock market and how much would be in the bank. The bank doesn't pay very much. Bonds don't yield very much. So this forces people to move into the stock market, but that is very, very risky. And the conventional wisdom that's quoted over and over again is, well, if you've got many years to retirement, don't worry about it. Things will come back. And Paul Samuelson was very much opposed to that. He felt that there's always a chance that even over a very long period of time, markets will not recover, and that there's this ever-present risk. And boy, was he right, considering what's happened over the last 10 to 15 years. So I hope I've done justice to his viewpoint that stocks do not become safer as you get into longer time horizons, and there's an always a present risk there.
Well, and in fact, his point that always used to stir up the community of hotshot MBAs around us all, at the time when I was a student there, I was a little bit older than most of my classmates, was, pshaw, that you would ever go and move your money into cash, even for a short-term position, as you watch the markets move around. Of course, this was back in the 80s, nothing like the volatility we see today, but certainly he would be quite a listen-to voice in this day and age, wouldn't he? Or we'd hope he would be.
And not only that, I think many of his students that are certainly alive and still active today have continued that message, and they always quote him, and they certainly say it in his name. So in response to your question, I do hope that he's sitting up in heaven and certainly looking at this and saying, yep, he got what I was saying.
That's right. Well, you know, I did have to also smile, not just how you concluded the book, setting us up for a sequel, but also you did sneak in a crash course on natural and unnatural logarithms in the appendix. So, you know, to soothe the savage beast of the mathematician that picked up your book, I assume, too.
Well, the story of that is that material was originally in the beginning of the book, in part of chapter one, where I first mentioned logarithms, and that was one of the things that would have ended up on the floor of the editing room, so to speak, had I not insisted that somewhere, someplace, we have to remind people what a logarithm is.
Yes, and that's when the snooze factor might kick in from some people that pick it up.
The very, very end is what they wanted.
What I think the other message I picked up from your book, again, for those of you who may have just tuned in, we're speaking with Moshe Milevsky. He's a professor at York University, and his latest book is called The 7 Most Important Equations for Your Retirement, The Fascinating People and Ideas Behind Planning Your Retirement Income. This is not, as you would say, a Susie Orman or another Get Rich Quick or How Do I Move It in the Stock Market book. However, there's enough nice education in here for any of us that are staring down some of those tougher decisions wherever you are in your life planning cycle, that this isn't an important read. So I commend you for that. It's a different approach that kind of opens up your aperture. My next question, Moshe, is the fact that you have these 7 equations that really are irrespective of geography and intellectual time and space. In other words, you've got, you know, Fibonacci from Italy, you've a representative from the Slavic countries, from the U.S. Your community of financial know-how truly is that global, isn't it?
It is. In fact, I was just literally last week giving a presentation on this book in Beijing in China. I went there for 2 weeks with the family because I was invited to speak at the Chinese Academy of Sciences. And I was a little bit worried about getting up and speaking about Western, for the most part, mathematicians and economists in a country where they have a very, very long tradition and long history of doing their own research and their own mathematics. And for the most part, the response that I got was, yes, you picked the right people. One of the people I profiled was Andrei Kolmogorov, a Russian mathematician who was very familiar to the Chinese mathematical community. And so there is something that transcends geography and certainly nationalism, where people say, you know what, these people really made a contribution, even if they are in a different political and economic system that we live in. And there's a recognition there. It's almost apolitical. It's neutral of nationalism. It's very much, yes, this individual, regardless of his political views, really made an important contribution to mathematics, and we acknowledge him for that.
As you step back and studied these 7 individuals, though, and by the way, were there others on the list, or were these the 7 that you ended up from the get-go focusing on?
I had one or two other ones that could have been a close call. There was a Dutch mathematician, Huygens, that I was thinking of considering, but really Andrei Kolmogorov took him a little bit further. There was a very, very well-known Leonard Euler mathematician that had done a tremendous amount of work, but he hadn't quite grappled with retirement planning problems, and I tried to mention them in the book. I didn't create a chapter on them, but I certainly gave them credit where it's due.
Well, and you know, if I look at the dates here of these 7 individuals, none of them really were contemporaries of the other. in any, and there's some overlap in certainly other dates, but were any of them of the same members of the Academy communities collaborate on anything?
Yeah. The only two that should have overlapped, but I'm not quite sure why they never did, mm-hmm. are Irving Fisher and Solomon Huebner. They were both professors. One of them was at Wharton in Pennsylvania, the other one at Yale. And, you know, they were interested in similar problems. One was more of an insurance theorist, the other one was more of an economist, but they both were interested in personal financial matters. They wanted to help individuals reach their retirement goals and manage their financial affairs. But I've yet to find any evidence that the two ever met, even though they were both very active. So they lived around the same time. They certainly overlapped in a calendar perspective, but very much one built on the other. So someone like Edmund Halley came well before Benjamin Gomperz, and Benjamin Gomperz came well before Irving Fisher, and so on. So other than those two, there really wasn't much overlap.
So tell me now, the quant guy that you are, financial, scientist, mathematics, you've now written a qualitative book that certainly has some lace and ties and short strings to the financial world, of course. But how do you feel having written this book now is pulling you in some new directions, Moshe?
Well, you know, I feel that you can reach a much, much wider audience when you can talk about quantitative ideas in a qualitative manner. You can reach a much wider audience when you're writing a biography or you're talking about the life of people than when you're focusing just purely on the dry mathematics. So in some sense, I've been bitten here, and it's going to change the way I write things and to present things from the perspective, the historical perspective, also to appreciate the history of things. I mean, I've learned that there's very little original right. in this field. I mean, if you look hard enough, you'll find somebody who did this before. And to discover that time value of money was created 800 years ago, not, you know, 50 years ago at the Harvard Business School was, to me, an eye-opener. And I think the appreciation for making sure that you really get the source correct is something that comes out of this.
Yeah. The fact that you took that trip to China, do you think now this is going to open your mind to considering some scholars, indeed, from other geographies and nationalities, though, as you, whatever that next book title might be?
Well, I don't think I missed anyone. I certainly appreciate the contribution that they've had and the work that they did. Some of their scholars, numerically speaking, astronomers. So if I was writing a book about astronomy, obviously I would be including them and some of their scholars from literally 2,000 years ago. But what I've learned or sort of what I picked up from my 2 weeks in China is that retirement is a global issue.
Right.
This isn't just a North American phenomena where, gee, I want to take Social Security. Should I take it at 62, or should I wait till I'm 70 and get more? Every single country, every culture is struggling with the exact same thing. At some point in your life, you will be unable to work, but you are going to live 20 or 30 years longer than that. How do we finance that? And how do we do this in a way that's accurate and honest? And I think that that's a global problem.
Well, and also if it's in your stream of thinking, not just how you're going to spend it to live that kind of life, but what kind of legacy you're going to lead and how might you pass that on to the next generations, whether it be your family or your philanthropic interest, too.
Sure, and making sure that that's done in the most effective way possible is also something that, you know, financial instruments can help with. If what you really want to do is leave something to the next generation, there might be better ways to do it than simply leaving it in the bank until you pass on in 20 or 30 years. Maybe an insurance policy is the way to do it. Maybe an annuity is the way to do it. So the usage of financial instruments, and that's really what Solomon Huebner was talking about when he talked about using insurance to achieve your legacy goals, I think that's, again, a global issue.
Absolutely. Well, it's a real pleasure to have met today. Our guest was Dr. Moshe Milevsky from York University in Canada, in Toronto. His book, The 7 Most Important Equations for Your Retirement. Thanks so much, and have fun answering the email or the knock on the door to see the reactions to this wonderful new book.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity.
My pleasure. Have a great afternoon.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Bye. Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it. Going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.